Bro, our business was rated the 71st best company to work for by Fortune magazine last year. Not a paid thing, it's not like a little badge, no, like fortune.com. Yeah. What did I learn through that process? Two things. Every survey that came back said, A, we were transparent about our goals, and B, we coached the team.
Pieces of advice that I could give anyone is the advice you don't take is so much more important than the advice you do take.
Yeah.
And if you want to maximize and master just one skill,
yeah,
I think the most important skill, yeah, is
there's so many ways to add value to your company most people don't know about. They just think, oh, my net profit times a multiple. No, there's a million and one things you can do to control multiple of a company. One of them is test the aptitude of your team. And if the aptitude of your team goes from 3 out of 10 to 7 out of 10, you can prove to a venture capitalist that your team is getting smarter.
And the value of that is so inherently high.
You can literally go from, let's say, a 7x multiple to a 14x multiple.
How do you do that? So what would you advise lawyers in this upcoming recession, mm-hmm, to do?
Well, I don't think it's advising lawyers. I think it's advising entrepreneurs what to do.
They gave me these checks and said, just wait until 2 weeks to deposit them. And all of those checks bounced. I told them, look, man, it seems like you're not gonna pay me. Let me just come back and get my stuff. Mm. They said, if you come back to New Orleans, we're gonna put a bullet in your head.
Whoa.
Do you think it's selfish to make a lot of money and not share how you got there with other people?
Yes, I do. And I bet, again, it's just my life purpose. I think you need to share it in a way that goes to someone's level, though. Like, there's this example that I use on public speaking. Like, I could tell someone how to sell, you know, exactly how to sell $2 million from stage.
Yeah.
Step by step. Here's the step-by-step method,
yeah,
that you can follow. You would be able to implement that.
Yeah.
You already have.
Yeah, it's fine.
Right? But if I hand that to 1 million human beings, they're not going to be able to do anything with that. So I'm better off teaching them a principle of persuasion that they can use in a micro sales hack in their lives, yeah, if I really want to inspire them.
Like convincing their kid to eat vegetables.
Right.
Like, let's start there before something you sell small. $2 million from the stage.
Right. So that's where, like, for example, like Mike Morse's book, Fireproof.
Yeah.
Everyone talks about it. And how many firms have grown as a result of it? I don't know.
I mean, his firm is fireproof. Mine's bulletproof.
But my point is, like, you can give someone a playbook on how you built a 9-figure firm, and that doesn't guarantee that you're going to learn the habits that got you there.
You know what I'm skeptical of? I'm skeptical of people who go into coaching once their business has plateaued.
Yeah.
I want coaches who are growing at the same time as they're, yeah, teaching.
Exactly, because it's different advice.
Yeah, and yeah, so, and then it keeps your finger on the pulse. And so, and I'm not going to mention any names, but there are certainly people who realize they've hit a plateau in their income, mm-hmm, and they decide, let me create a secondary revenue stream.
Income stream, yeah.
Right, from just coaching people.
Yeah.
And I know that I could have a much bigger coaching business if I were to kind of like let the law firm go, yeah, by the wayside. Mm-hmm. But I kind of built this lifestyle where I'm running my business, I'm running my law firm, mm-hmm, and I'm kind of just teaching people what I'm doing along the way.
Yeah.
And that is the coaching program.
Yeah, exactly. Instead
of saying, let me teach you all the stuff that I learned 5 years ago.
That's because, my coaching program.
Yeah. No. You're doing the exact same thing I'm doing.
Yeah.
You're a practitioner, uh-huh, in the digital agency space.
That's what I'm saying.
Which is interesting because I feel like there's a whole market of teaching marketers,
yeah,
how to build 8-figure firms and 8-figure, yeah, agencies, uh-huh, that you haven't even tapped into yet.
No, I get asked. I get asked all the time because it's so funny, dude. The biggest problem that marketing agency businesses have is what?
Getting clients.
That is not my problem.
You know what's funny?
So like when people
they want you to hire them to bring in clients,
yeah, yeah,
and they're,
yeah,
struggling to get you to come to them.
That's what I'm saying. So like that is the number one pain point. I can't relate to that pain point. So like
yeah, you know, I have the same problem with my PI practice.
Do I really want to go backwards and have to explain 101 on how to get clients? Like that's why I don't coach agency owners, is because I'm like, I'm worried I'm going to downgrade my momentum by having to reflect on like things that just came naturally to me.
Let me give,
like,
you a mindset shift then. You started acquiring businesses, right?
Mm-hmm.
We don't have to get into it unless you want to,
yeah,
publicly. Who all have you acquired so far?
Well, I mean, we technically, it's a merger strategy in essence, but technically, you know, Andy and Ethan's companies.
And so they're not, when you call it a merger, I look at what name remains. Mm-hmm. If the name is Andy Stickle, then that's who actually acquired.
Yeah.
If the name is TKO, then that's who actually acquired. But the name is SMB.
Yeah.
So there's clearly a funnel up.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let me give you the mindset shift of coaching.
Mm-hmm.
What if coaching is not about the $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, $7,000 a month that you generate from your clients?
Yeah, it's an M&A strategy.
Coaching is about identifying future business partners. Yeah. Instead of spending your time and money to find those people, they pay you to come to you.
That's,
and their ability to execute determines whether they become a business partner.
That's Grant Cardone's funnel.
So why aren't you doing that?
Well, that is the that's the plan long term.
And you don't have to do it in a big scale.
Yeah,
you just need a couple of clients. And by the way, that's the first step.
Yeah.
Is restructuring your mindset for a coaching program. Mm-hmm. Saying instead of these people being my clients, I'm thinking of a bigger play where they could possibly become business partners.
Yep.
What ends up happening is you bypass the whole coaching program altogether.
Yeah.
Like a Hormozi strategy.
Mm-hmm. That is it. Hormozi modeled his strategy based on Cardone Ventures. He had two one-on-one calls.
It was more
calls.
On like Roland Frazier.
Yeah, Roland Frazier does it too, but the approach that Cardone follows with Cardone Ventures is a mass marketing approach that funnels to a acquisition of some sorts, but really it's brilliant. It's brilliant. Yeah, I know Grant can be, you know, a little bit salesy.
No, I've seen the umbrella of companies. There's like 30 different Cardone Venture companies.
Yeah.
And so you're saying he just gets people to his events to identify people like you that are like, I'll pay $500,000 to be in the same room with you. And then all of a sudden he's like, well, shit, what do you actually do?
Yeah.
Oh, you're a digital marketer for lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't mind getting into that business.
Yeah.
And because he's got a $5.2 billion assets under management, mm-hmm. it increases the multiple of your company when you're going to close because you've associated yourself with a 10-figure company.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the conglomeration valuation multiple concept. So, for example, when
conglomeration valuation multiple concept.
Yeah.
I like that.
So, conglomeration valuation multiple, right? So, when you conglomerate 2 ounces, 1 ounce of revenue, 1 ounce of revenue, and it becomes 2 ounces of revenue, obviously the multiple goes higher. But all of that assumes that there's going to be a transaction event at some point. So, if there's no transaction event, then all that's hoopla. Right? Or if the person's going to get bought out at that higher multiple. But that's part of my strategy. That's why we branched into different businesses, is because the business becomes more diversified. It's so fascinating, dude. Like, and the gross revenue goes higher, which then increases our multiple. It's so interesting, though. You know you're doing the right thing when you get less and less supporters towards the big decisions, right? So we met with this multiple venture capital firms. We got offered $45 million cash for our company. And when we met with this firm, we turned it down. They started giving us all these red flags and things they didn't like and all this crap. And then we go talk to this other VC firm who said they would be willing to offer us way more than $45 million. They didn't do a hard offer though. And all the stuff that the first VC firm said wasn't valuable, too much diversification, they said, we need a specialist, like all this crap. The other VC said the complete opposite thing. They said, no, we like diversification. We like you bolting on additional revenue streams. So what I learned from those two polar opposite conversations is I choose who I listen to, and ultimately a buyer is going to determine the price of my business. It's not some freaking multiple that's going to determine the value of my business. If someone, this is where strategic partnerships are key. If someone sees that by buying my company with 100,000 lawyers on an email list and all the events that we do, if someone buys my company and sees how they can use my company to make $200 million, they're going to pay me $200 million, or maybe a little bit less
than
that.
Half at least, yeah.
Right? So it has nothing to do with all this crazy calculative crap that people sell you on. It has to do with what is a buyer willing to sign a check for based on their reasons.
That's value in every sense of the word when you're talking about the economic value of any product or service, including your company.
Yeah.
It's not all these crazy VC, like you see these 30x multiples on tech companies because they're looking at lifetime value of the client and 30 times EBITDA. It's like,
and people
none
get
of that matters unless you have a buyer with a check in hand.
Yeah, that and like everyone has this fantasy around SaaS companies. I'm going to bolt software onto my company and become rich.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you forgot.
FinTech.
Yeah, you forgot that people have to use the software. If no one uses your software, you are not getting a 30x multiple, because the only reason you get a 30x multiple is because there's a sense of predictable future cash flows.
It's a residual income, lifetime value of the client. They're
has
on a
to be sticky.
You know, yeah.
If you don't have an in-house software team, one of the biggest business mistakes I made was, and Andy and I both made the mistake together, was ReviewJudge. We created a review generation software for attorneys. Andy created it. I bought it. And it was a $1 million mistake, and it was the best mistake I ever learned, because we half-assed a software product, and we got exactly what we deserved.
You need real engineers for that.
Yeah, and that's not our core competency. And I owned at that point, I'm a service business owner. I can crush it in services. And maybe one time in the future, when I have the resources, I'll get into software. Bro, I went down the rabbit hole, dude. Like, I learned about product market fit. I learned about user testing. It was fun.
Founder market fit.
Yeah, it was fun, but it wasn't my forte. So.
You know, you just mentioned something earlier, which I think is one of the best pieces of advice that I could give anyone, is the advice you don't take is so much more important than the advice you do take.
Yeah.
And if you want to maximize and master just one skill, I think the most important skill is knowing when to identify a qualified person.
Wow.
Usually, gold. The least qualified people are the ones that love you the most.
Yeah.
Because they give you these opinions out of fear and love, because they think they're protecting you based on their own inherent knowledge that they've had over the years. So my mom has always wanted me to be an employee and go work at a company. And it's like, you want to go, like, go and work for a company. Mm-hmm. They give you benefits. They give you health insurance. You get to wear a suit every day. And I'm like, Mom, what if I owned that company?
Yeah.
What if I gave people health insurance? What if I told people to wear suits? What if I'm the one that's on the website and all this stuff? And it's like, that's not our, what we do.
We work. Yeah.
We don't create companies. Yeah. We work.
Yeah.
And her mindset completely changed when I pulled up with a brand new Mercedes with her name on it.
Mm-hmm.
That was in 2018.
Yeah.
And so all of a sudden she's like, well, seems like this thing is working.
Mm-hmm.
And so 100%, the most important piece of advice is understanding which advice to take and which advice not to take.
The other things around net profit, right? Like last year, our company profited we have high, decently high owner's compensation, I would say. But if you look at the intrinsic profit margin of our business, we only really profited $2.5-3 million. That's not a lot for the revenues that we're doing. And
well, if you're in hyper growth mode and you're reinvesting a lot of it
back
into your growth.
So when we went through this analysis on the value of our business, we segmented out. I learned so many, dude. I got the craziest hack I'll share with you in a second.
Let's go.
Testing the aptitude of your team and how that increases over time. All right, I got to share it.
Let's go.
All right, so I met this guy, and he said that there's so many ways to add value to your company that most people don't know about. They just think, oh, my net profit times a multiple. No, there's a million and one things you can do to control multiple of a company. One of them is test the aptitude of your team. In essence, test the IQ of your team, start it at date X, and then end the test on date Y. Let's say it's a 2-year window. And if the aptitude of your team goes from 3 out of 10 to 7 out of 10, you can prove to a venture capitalist that your team is getting smarter.
And the value of that is so inherently high.
You can literally go from, let's say, a 7x multiple to a 14x multiple.
Just because you can prove your team is smart.
Aptitude improvement.
Okay, so how do you do that?
You test your team.
Based on what metrics?
And then you you implement. It's a test.
It's an actual IQ test, or there's like personality assessments and Wunderlic and like...
Nope, it's no personality assessment at all. It's all aptitude. It's not behavioral characteristics or decision-making characteristics. It's all knowledge and speed of making... speed of operation is the way to look at it, right? So aptitude is how fast can you learn and what do you know, right? Similar to how IQ tests test you. But the point is, there's a million and one things that you can do to show to someone else that your company is becoming more valuable over time. And the net profit thing was another thing. We met with this agency conglomeration company, and the guy was super wealthy, and he was like, oh yeah, your agency is worth crap. You know, you didn't have as even close to the EBITDA that we wanted. I was like, did you hear my growth rate? Like 300% the last 2 years in a row. And he was like, yeah, but that doesn't matter. And I talked to the other guy, and he's like, yeah, we're gonna give you an extra like 5 points for your growth rate.
Yeah.
So, dude, at the end of the day, trust your gut.
Yeah.
Like, and you and I both know this, and we have gotten to where we're at by trusting our gut and understanding that, like, some people are going to criticize the decisions that we make on the outside. As long as we know what the plan is, I'm going to reinvest every freaking penny. I'll go negative, dude, to reinvest every penny because I know the opportunity cost of not investing. I know what I'm capable of. You know what you're capable of. You've proven it, what you're capable of. So to have the selfishness of pocketing money from your business when you've proven to yourself that you can triple and quadruple your revenue in 1 year, how selfish is that?
Well, and to
why
what end?
Why wouldn't you reinvest it?
But to what end? Like, when do you start paying
whenever
yourself?
You want to stop having an impact on the world. I'm in the impact game. I'm not in the, you know, kick my feet up game. I want to know that I made a splash, right? And until I get that itch scratched, maybe I'll change on that. But it's just simple investing. I mean, I pay myself a salary of $360,000 a year. So it's around $30,000 a month. That's my executive salary as CEO of S&B team. But that's real money.
Yeah.
I take that money. Okay. Everything other than that.
Just reinvested.
Is all a test. Other than our predictable marketing channels. When we hold an event, that's a predictable marketing channel. I know if I spend a dollar on an event, that's going to produce a certain ROI based on the people who show up to our event. That's predictable. That's not an experiment anymore. Google ads, that's not an experiment anymore. Facebook ad, lead gen, opt-in with a ebook lead magnet, that's not an experiment anymore. Sales team gets an ebook download, they call the lead, a certain percentage of them book appointments, a certain percentage of the appointments end up closing. That's not an experiment. Experiments are, we're going to do some crazy shit here.
Yeah.
Right? And I'm not even doing enough of that right now. So I need you to help me go into the crazy shit.
We'll get into that. It's just going to boil down to the same perspective that you have with your business development.
Mm-hmm.
You've already created a growth trajectory with your business.
Yeah.
But what about your personal brand?
Yeah.
So you have a business brand.
Yep.
And you're thinking about valuation of the company.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to ask you, so what is your number? If someone came to you and said, hey, here's how much I would offer you for your company right now, what's that number that you would actually consider saying yes?
For the size of our company right now? I'd really have to do the math on it. Because we're a service business, I probably would have a number. So it'd probably be somewhere around the 200 million mark right now. But that's just because you'd have to basically slice my neck to get me to stop playing the game right now. No one would offer my company that much though right now. So it's basically saying I'm not interested right now. I'm having too much fun.
Yeah, I think if someone offered me 200 million right now, that'd be kind of hard to turn down.
I would want my whole team to win. That's my thing is I would not.
Yeah,
feel
I'm paying
good.
Off everyone's mortgages. Like everyone's cars are getting paid off. Credit cards getting paid off. And
for me, like that's what I love about business is the feeling that when the company wins, everyone wins, and that's why Bro, our business was rated the 71st best company to work for by Fortune magazine last year. Not a paid thing. It's not like a little badge. No, like Fortune.com. Secret shop, the members of our team surveyed them on thousands and thousands and thousands of businesses, and we were 71st in the United States, which sucks. Who wants to be 71st at anything?
Yeah, not even top 80.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it's terrible. Not even top 70. I mean, Jesus. But what did I learn through that process? Two things. Every survey that came back said, A, we were transparent about our goals, and B, we coached the team. And that came back as the two most commonly used elements when our team was interviewed for that survey. We're transparent about our goals, and we coach the team. Transparency to me is I never want to hide anything from the team. I want everyone to know how much money we're making, how much money we're not making, how much money I'm making, how much we're reinvesting, the stuff that didn't work well. I want them to know everything. I want them to be able to, if it was up to me, they would have a portal. They would click in and they would be able to see every single financial of the company, including what everyone in the company gets paid. But I hear that that's not allowed.
It is allowed. If it's a private company, you can do whatever you want. But yeah, that's actually, we have a Truvy dashboard. So there's a software company called Truvy. And it basically takes all of your software programs and puts them all together on one dashboard.
Yeah.
And so you can actually do that with a software and then limit certain things. Like, we obviously are not going to show everyone the social security numbers of all of our team members, right? And we probably aren't going to share the salaries of each individual team member. Mm-hmm. But we do show them in buckets and show like, hey, here's what the entire payroll is costing for the firm. And here's what the owner benefit is looking like, the TOB. Here's what the profit margins are looking like. And most of the time, it really just boils down to, like, how quickly are we training and recruiting A players, training them on our systems, and then pushing them to go to that next level.
Every company needs a salary cap too. Yeah. Like, you got to be transparent about your salary cap. Like, a sports team has a salary cap and it's public. Like, there's no negotiation with the salary cap, right? And oftentimes people forget this, right? Is that, like, if you want to be a part of an A player culture, that's what our culture is a team of A players, then we're going to pay you more than the average person.
And we're going to train you up to the salary cap.
We're going to train you as well as we can so you perform at the highest level. And with that comes levels of expectation. If you are a core value fit and you are performing, you get to keep your job next year. That's the reward of an A player team, right? That's a pretty big reward if you're getting paid above market average, right? What most people do is they pay their team too low and they're always playing catch-up ball. People are asking for raises because it's really a culture problem. The culture problem is that we haven't educated our team that we pay our team a little bit more than what they're worth, and we expect a little bit more than other companies as a result of that, right?
So what's a typical salary cap?
So I look at it as 40% of your gross revenues as a salary cap. If we want to make it simple, 40% of gross revenues. If you have, now salary cap can also include cost of goods sold.
But so you don't actually have individual positions where you institute a salary cap. You don't say, hey, the most you're going to make in this job is 100K. It's going to take you probably 3 to 5 years to get to that point. But after that, if you want to get paid more, you have to generate revenue for the company.
So it's okay, I see what you're saying. Yeah. So there's role salary caps and then there's departmental salary caps. So
talking about an organizational salary cap. Yeah, you're playing the ratio game.
Right. So organizational salary cap is the overall company amount of gross revenue we can spend on payroll, or cost of goods sold with full-time equivalent 1099s, right?
So yours is 40%.
40% is the cap. We 40%. Want to be more efficient than that, though.
Do you still abide by the revenue per employee model?
Yes. If you have highly talented people, my belief is you should have a group of people who grow your company. So every time you get close to your salary cap, your gross revenue should be increasing.
Which means they never have a salary cap.
Exactly. The salary cap is
always increasing. So it's not a salary cap individually per position. It's a salary cap organizationally. We're not going to pay more than 40% of our revenues for compensation.
There is a role-specific one. Let me explain departmental, though. Departmental is on my agency business. I know that we want to have we're going to have a 40% cap on our agency business, on just agency-related revenue. So if someone hires us for marketing, let's say they pay $6,000 a month and $4,000 of that is attributed to the marketing services, we're gonna basically carve out that $4K a month equivalent. That becomes our new revenue equation. And then we have a micro salary cap for the agency, right? So we're only willing to spend 40% of agency-related revenue, which brings down that company-wide number.
I see.
Because it's on a smaller portion
so
of revenue.
So that doesn't include other revenue, like maybe affiliate marketing or your personal speaking. I don't know, do you get paid for speaking?
I don't do speaking. Yeah, I just do my own. But it doesn't include any other revenue sources, is the point. So then we play the game salary cap departmentally there. Our coaching program, we have a different salary cap and we have a lower threshold for that. We have a 10% salary cap on our coaching related revenue because it's a higher margin service. It's more intellectual property based, right? So they are buying our coaching for a system and know-how. Therefore that needs to be reflected, right? In the salary cap we're willing to do, right? And then marketing, we kind of treat separately.
Wait, if it's a higher value skill mm-hmm. that you basically have in this position, which is the coaching, mm-hmm. you're saying it's reflected in the salary cap by it being a lower salary
cap? Lower salary cap. We should need less people to deliver on a coaching service because people are buying our coaching for an intellectual property of sorts. Right? They're buying coaching for know-how. So coaching should be a higher net profit, or I should say gross profit sale.
I guess coaching, yes. Consulting, no.
Agency services, when someone hires us to do their marketing, more clients equals more hours, more work. Therefore, it is more expensive for us to sign up a marketing agency client than it is a coaching client.
Understood, yeah.
Because more clients, more work.
Got it.
Coaching doesn't necessarily mean more work. It does, but on a 4 times lower scale.
Yeah.
That's all.
It's an incremental increase in the amount of work compared to an exponential growth in revenue.
Right.
That's why everyone wants to get into the coaching business.
Exactly.
That's why and there's also people that are in the coaches business.
Yeah. But Well, that's the biggest piece of coaches in terms of quantity and all the ones who are broke too, is how to build your own coaching business. From someone who hasn't done it.
Come pay me to teach you how to do something that I haven't done myself.
Yeah, while I learn it myself.
You know, this is the problem with MBAs and like educated people that went to college and grad school is that they think they have the skill because they read about it.
Yeah.
And from an abstract perspective, they can look at a problem and say, oh, here's the solution. I'm going to consult you and tell you what to do. But from an action perspective, they lack it because they've never been there. Mm-hmm. And so we have that. So we do have some of those highly educated people in our organization. And I have to almost like mold them to stop thinking just abstract, here's what you need to do, here's the problem. Because they'll look at something and say, you know what? I really think we need to have our shelf life for this type of case to be lower. And he's like, that's all I'm focused on. Get that number lower. Get that number lower. Get that number lower. Okay, well, hold on a second. Do you know what that involves?
Yeah.
You do realize that involves beefing up this team, having these systems in place every step of the way. You're going to have case managers that need to add this additional system. Yep. And the net value of all of that does not make up for the specific metric that you're looking for. So I force them to get their hands dirty to understand. And then now they have respect to team members. When it comes to saying, oh, here's a problem that we have, here's how we address it.
Yeah.
Right? Because if you don't have that pulse of the organization, like if you're looking at numbers on a spreadsheet, it doesn't tell the true story of the business.
Not at all.
And so that's why I love using software programs that kind of give you like this additional insight.
Financial storytelling is key. We have a full-time role dedicated to just financial storytelling. And Monique is her name, and her job is to basically interpret data and tell us stories about it. Right? So we invested X dollars here, and here's what we learned about that. And here's how we can make new decisions based on this information. That's where I learned my speaker fees problem. Last year, I got all these paid speakers for my events, and I spent almost $1 million on speaker fees, you know, 700-ish thousand. And I found out that over 3/4 of my speaker fees were wasted.
Yeah.
They were not needed at all.
I didn't get any of that 700.
Yeah.
See, but that's the thing. I also realize sometimes the free tickets and the people that are there because they have something of value to share with
people. You probably sold more tickets to the event that you spoke at, that we promoted you at, than Alex Rodriguez did.
Yeah, I don't think A-Rod added much value to your specific event. Yeah. And some people, and so this was kind of like, there are event holders that think, I just need a really, really big name to attract people.
Yeah.
And so as long as you have like Shaquille O'Neal there, there's going to be people that are there just to listen to Shaq. But like, what about the actual service that I'm selling?
Exactly.
What if we just focus on delivering phenomenal value to people? And I don't know. That's
why we have this event coming up. We have no keynotes, zero keynotes. We didn't pay one speaker for this event that we have coming up. They're all current clients of ours, and we've already sold 1,400 tickets to it. We're going to exceed 2,500 tickets for this event. And you know what's interesting? Is when you remove a crutch like that in your marketing, like I need a speaker, it forces you to up your messaging. It forces you to get better with your copywriting and better with how you convey value.
So this is an interesting segue because it's like you're now building the confidence that your product alone is good enough for people to buy tickets.
And that was a self-confidence issue I had.
I've had that probably way more than I should have. For me, I call it just ego.
Yeah.
I intentionally have very high prices for my programs and my products because it's like, and straight up, I had someone ask me like, hey, it's 10 grand to come to this event. Like, that's a lot of money. And I'm like, yeah, but if I didn't charge you that much, you wouldn't respect it.
Yeah.
You wouldn't respect the knowledge that I'm giving you.
To do business with us, it costs $78,000 a year. No negotiation. So we have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of clients paying us $78,000 a year. And we also have the highest ratings in the industry. We haven't received a one-star review in 5 years. Like, not one. It's crazy. We have 1,000 video testimonials. Like, and it's because, we offer good service, great service, but I'm not dumb enough to think that the price that we charge doesn't make our clients pay attention. Our clients pay attention when they buy from us. We're not just I'll test it out.
Yeah.
It's a pretty damn big decision to say, I'm going to spend 80 grand a year. I'm going to sign up with this. So they actually utilize our coaching program. So to your point, that was one of the biggest myths I learned in sales. I remember when I first started doing events, I sold a $1,500 a month package. It was a PPC management package. The first time I sold on stage. And I got 20 people to sign up for it. Oh my God, it was amazing.
Yeah.
And I gave a 3-month contract because I was scared that people were going to fight against the contract.
Yeah.
And now I sell a $78,000 offer from stage on 12-month contracts, right? With auto renewal. And it's easier. We make more sales now because I don't have faulty price beliefs. If you're not making the money that you want to make in your life, it says more about your beliefs about money than anything else. Like, I just don't believe $78,000 is a lot of money. Do you?
I mean, not as a business owner.
Like,
I think if you're trying to go from $1 million to $2 million, $78,000 makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
But then it really does involve partly the confidence to sell, but also the confidence in your product.
Yeah.
So there's two different types of confidences that you need to establish in order to have a successful business.
Yep.
First, and I think it's more important to confidently create a good product or service.
Yep.
And for me, I have a successful law firm because I'm a really good personal injury lawyer. Like, dude, I know this shit very, very well, surprisingly well. And I think I surprise people when I start talking about all the nuances of personal injury and insurance claims and how to structure cases in order to maximize the value. And I'll go toe-to-toe with people about all the different types of injuries and injections and surgeries and all the different types of doctors that you can see and the insanely deep. People don't expect it. And because I built the confidence in my knowledge, I now have such a strong confidence in the sales aspect because I'm so good at what you do that it would be a shame that you didn't hire me.
Yeah. That's the ultimate belief, right? Jay Abraham, I interviewed Jay Abraham four times. I did a joint venture with him on stage, and he's the right hand of Tony Robbins, the number one motivational speaker in the world. And he did the marketing advising for Tony Robbins building his brand. And he said, and I didn't understand it when he first said it, but he said, until you believe you're ripping people off by not selling something to them, you have not hit your full stride, is what he said. And I really had to reflect on that for a while. And then...
Sounds like a life insurance line.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, but I'll tell you, though, it's... I don't believe in life insurance, and it's a religious thing, but when you've experienced... If you're a life insurance salesman or a mm-hmm. car insurance salesman or you provide any sort of service mm-hmm. and you've experienced not selling something to someone and then a catastrophe happens and yep. had they had that service or product mm-hmm. that you had offered, it would have completely changed their lives. And yeah. you felt so guilty that they didn't get this incredible product or service because you know the value yeah. of it. And you go through that pain, mm-hmm. then your mindset shifts. I'm not trying to sell you something.
Yeah.
You need this. And if I yeah. don't give this product yeah. to you, you are going to hurt yourself. Yep. And I'm not going to allow that to happen.
Yeah. And this is where I've come to own what my role is in my marketing function as a company. My role is to, currently, as we're doing lawyers, right? And we will expand outside of lawyers at one point.
And I want to know why you started with lawyers, but we'll get to
yeah.
that.
My job is to inspire lawyers to understand that they, A, are running a business, and B, that they have to invest as such. And embedded within all that is that they also have a vision. And that sounds so stupid.
Yeah.
I have to convince people they have vision? That's, everyone can see. Like...
It's the ego problem of being educated. Just like doctors feel like they can fly planes, and that's why they have planes specifically codenamed the Doctor Killers, lawyers also think that because they went to college for 7 years, that automatically they're just smart people.
Yeah.
And so the same skills that they had invested to become a master litigator in 10 years, uh-huh. 15 years, they think it's going to naturally flow over into yeah. being a strong business mm-hmm. person and marketing acumen and infrastructure yeah. and hiring and
no,
systems and operations.
But here's what I'm going to say. The reason I got 70,000 lawyers to attend webinars of mine, which is crazy to say, is because I believe in what I teach so strongly. I teach lawyers that they have to spend at least 20% of their revenue on marketing because I saw my dad not do that. I saw him lose everything with a $500 a month Yellow Page budget. That didn't hold him afloat when the world crumbled in 2008. Like, I refuse to not educate people on this. I saw my dad without a vision for his company. I saw what happened as a result of that. If you have a vision, dude, if you're clear on where you're going, I don't care if a recession hits, I don't care what the hell happens. You're gonna figure it out. You're gonna turn every adversity into an opportunity, which is one of my company's core values. COVID hit. I knew what my gross revenues were going to be before COVID hit. I had already written it down. I'd already repeated it to myself every single day, like I do with my goal setting, every single day. So COVID was a reason to triple my revenues. We went from 1.5 to 4.5 million that year. I know you exponentially grew your law firm through
yeah,
COVID.
Yeah, I think this is a good topic about when a catastrophe strikes, you never let a calamity go to waste.
No.
And so COVID was a huge... opportunity because everyone was scaling back on their marketing and their ad spend mm-hmm. and there weren't people driving on the road, so every personal injury lawyer stopped running ads. Mm-hmm. So this was a big blue ocean for me.
Yeah.
Luckily, I had a very profitable year the year before.
Uh-huh.
I just put pedal to the metal and yeah. put all that money back into marketing.
Yeah.
That year, we broke 8 figures.
Yeah.
And it's doubled in growth every single year. Mm-hmm. Since starting, the first year you'll have 47,000% growth.
Yeah.
You know, because
yeah.
you're starting with a dollar.
Uh-huh.
47,000% growth, then 3,000% growth, and then it's like capped off at like 200, 150, 100% yeah. growth. Mm-hmm. And that's capped off for me.
Yeah.
But it's interesting because we're going into another recession.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of economic indicators right now that suggest with Silicon Valley Bank going yeah. under.
Big deal.
With... crypto kind of like stabilizing and going down with all these tech companies mm-hmm. not experiencing the same side part of growth that they thought they were going to have, inflation through the roof, unemployment stagnant,
mm-hmm.
another opportunity is about to emerge.
Yeah.
So what would you advise lawyers in this upcoming recession mm-hmm. to do?
Well, I don't think it's advising lawyers. I think it's advising entrepreneurs what to do. Because if you're still calling yourself a lawyer, there's a severe problem, right? You're an entrepreneur. Everyone listening to this can be and is an entrepreneur in some way, shape, or form because you're trading your services for something. If not, you don't have money. And if you don't have money, you can't eat. So if you're working for someone or not, like you are working within a business. But the the number one thing I would say is to learn sales. Like that, it just always comes down to learning how to communicate your message in some way, shape, or form. If you don't know how to communicate, the only other option is to get so good at something that someone will pay you money for your skills, regardless of your communication skills. That's it. I call them skills and sales skills. Skills is doing the thing, right? So doctors, a lot of lawyers, they mastered their skills. Problem is, most of these people aren't crushing it. Sales skills can be applied to any skills. And you can hire people with skills when you have sales. And sales skills, I found, working with hundreds of entrepreneurs, masterminds I'm a part of, you're a part of a ton of high-level masterminds, I've learned that sales skills, for a small percentage of people, transfer into marketing skills. And marketing skills and sales skills, for a small percentage of people, transfer into leadership skills. And the skill to transfer vision to other people is communication. The skill to paint a picture of where you're going by when, and to make other people want to join that with you, which Andy, myself, and Ethan, I feel we're all part of a vision. Technically, I am the visionary of SMB team, but I go to bed at night feeling like I'm joining visions with people, which is why people feel that they have autonomy within my vision. They don't feel like it's Bill's vision or the highway. We're on this vision together. And the communication skills that it takes to convey that are the same skills that I was doing when I was doing one-on-one sales calls with yellowpages.com, getting hung up on by contractors. It's just articulated differently. And there's a different level of delegation happening where when I was the one doing one-on-one sales, I was worried about making a sale. Well, now, as a leader, I'm worried about the person worried about making a sale. I'm still worried. It's just a different category of worry, you know? And worry is a great thing if it's harnessed properly, right? So
I think that's one of my mentors who's a billionaire once told me that the role of the CEO and the visionary is to have such a big enough dream and vision that everyone else's dream fits inside it.
Yeah.
And then your goal and your job every single day is to sell that vision to your people so they stay on the same track and they ride or die.
Yeah, that's what my vivid vision is.
I want to ask you, why did you start with legal?
Yeah, so this is, okay, the real bare bones story is quit yellowpages.com. And when I quit yellowpages.com, so I was doing sales. I was literally cold calling attorneys. And cold calling contractors, primarily contractors. When I quit yellowpages.com, I became the number one sales rep in the company. I quit right after because I didn't believe the product I was representing. I said, I'm gonna create a digital marketing company. All these people I was talking to during my sales process at Yellow Pages, they were struggling with marketing. So I ended up moving in with my dad when I quit the job, and I used my dad as the test dummy, right? And I built out all of his marketing and you know, built this whole Google Ads campaign for him. And he landed a $200,000 job in like 2 weeks of me launching the campaign.
The paving company.
Yeah. I was like, holy, and this is after the whole collapse of our family and everything. Yeah. So this is years later.
But he still had 35 years of skill in that industry. So it's like, we might as well use it.
Yeah. And then I learned how powerful Google Ads was. So I stopped there and I said, I'm going to master the skill of Google Ads. And then I'm going to master my sales skills from Yellow Pages, combine that together, and that was the birth of SMB Team. So for 8 months, I put together this vision. I was so scarred by my family's bankruptcy that I promised myself I wouldn't make a sale until I had a 10-year vision clear and on paper. So for 8 months, I put that vision together. I had a huge bonus check from the sales job, so I had the time to really think about my vision. And as soon as I got clear on the vision, I ran out of money, which was the best thing that ever happened to me.
Yeah.
Because I had this false sense of confidence from my bonus check from the sales job. And the best thing that ever happened was the day I ran out of money. I called my mom and I said, uh-oh, it happened again. Because this happened when I wrote the book, Worry 180. I ran out of money. No one bought my book, okay, because I didn't know how to market. So I call my mom and she's like, screw you, Bill. You just proved that you can sell. Go sell. And I was like, she hung up on me. I was like, my mom never hangs up on me. So I sold 8 contracts in my first month for $1,500 a month, right? So I went from zero to like over $10,000 a month in revenue. I was like, oh my God, I'm rich. Like yeah. It was the craziest feeling ever. And
this was what year?
This was 5 years ago. Yeah, okay. 5 years ago is when I made my first sale for S&B Team.
2018 is when you started the company?
Yep, 2018. Does that make sense? Yeah, wow, it's 2023? Jeez Louise. There's time gone. So, that's it. I made sales there. All the first sales weren't lawyers. They were contractors. Problem. Contractors don't pay their bills.
Yeah.
Okay? I learned a very valuable lesson. 2 of those 8, I said I'd do free work for, and then they could pay me later, and they never paid me. And I had, one or two lawyer referrals that came in shortly thereafter. And they were really happy because their average case value or average transaction value and profit per client was higher.
Yeah.
So then I bought this tool called Ibis World. And I was making the decision in my mind, do I want to specialize in contractors or lawyers? Because I read this book from Jason Swank, did this thing on how to build a marketing agency. And he said, you need to choose a niche.
Yeah.
Don't just do everything for everyone. So I said, I got to choose a niche. Is it going to be contractors or lawyers? So I went to ibisworld.com and I bought this $5,000 subscription to this research tool. And I looked at all these different verticals of business, plumbing, HVAC, roofing contractors, personal injury lawyer services, family law services, immigration lawyer services. I started seeing this interesting trend. All of the legal services verticals were what were called recession resilient. They were more recession resilient than discretionary income verticals like contracting, where someone needs money in their pocket to get their kitchen remodeled.
Right.
Right. Whereas in contingency fee, you don't need money out of your pocket to hire a personal injury lawyer. So, and when someone's getting deported, they find the money to hire an immigration lawyer.
Right.
Right. So there's a certain level of need.
And when someone's facing jail time,
they need a lawyer,
right?
Right. So when their freedom's at stake, they don't care. So I decided that I didn't want to go through what my family went through in 2008. So I said, I need to choose a recession-proof vertical. And that's why I chose lawyers. And we dialed in our processes. I ended up getting a ton of settlement funding clients as my first clients, the people that do the pre-suit funding and all that. And that worked well. And that led into a workers' comp referral, which led into another PI referral. So we started kind of honing that in. And then the best thing that ever happened in my life happened. And I say this with all due respect, COVID. And that's
I thought
really,
you were going to say you got married, but.
In business, I should
say.
Yeah. In personal life, that would be it.
COVID was such a huge blessing for me, man.
COVID was the defining moment of my entrepreneurship journey. I was just a sales dude before COVID. Like, I mean, I couldn't, it's just amazing. You know, it did a webinar on PPP loans for lawyers, my fourth webinar ever. I had 3,777 lawyers register for my fourth webinar ever. I knew nothing about the topic. I interviewed someone, built my email list by almost 4,000 with a 2-day promo sequence, 2 days. Of promotion. 3,777 lawyers registered for that webinar. And then that's when I met Jason Fladlin, who taught me how to pitch on webinars. And then that led to me joining Inner Circle with Russell Brunson. And that led to me learning, how to sell via webinar. And that's really where things started dominoing was, I will say this with humility, but with facts, we are in a group with some of the biggest virtual event people in the world. And we sell a higher per head rate than Tony Robbins, Grant Cardone. We are the best webinar pitch presenters right now in entrepreneurship. And we provide value along the process. We get flooded with 5-star reviews when we do these events. So that's the skill I decided to master was virtual one-to-many sales and leadership. And that's it. I cut everything else out. Now, if I could just learn how to blow up on social media like you, then, you know, then
well, you learned a very important skill, which was you never sell to broke people. And I learned that skill when I was, I learned that skill when I was 19 years old, when I had a wholesale car audio business and I loaded up an entire truck and trailer, drove all the way to New Orleans and decided to sell all this car audio to this, you know, these Palestinian guys that were running a car audio shop. First time they did it, it was like an $18,000 order. They gave me a bunch of checks, post-dated, and said, hey, just give us payments so that we can pay it over time. Cool, it worked out. I deposited the checks over the course of a few months, made $18,000 sale. As a teenager, that's pretty good money. Then the next time I placed an order was $25,000. Same thing, drove all the way over to New Orleans with this big truck and trailer because I didn't want to pay for shipping. Mm-hmm. I wanted to squeeze as much of the profits as I could. You know, I took a weekend off for college. They gave me these checks and said, just wait until 2 weeks to deposit them. And all of those checks bounced. Mm. Not a single dollar was made during that transaction. And I told them, look, man, it seems like you're not going to pay me. Let me just come back and get my stuff. Mm. They said, if you come back to New Orleans, we're going to put a bullet in your head.
Whoa.
And that was the time that I realized I never want to work and not get paid. Mm. So I was very, very stern about being a PI lawyer. I never took criminal defense cases. I speak three languages fluently and a couple others conversationally, so I could very easily be an immigration lawyer. Immigration work, decided not to do that. I worked in a real estate firm and business litigation firm. I have an MBA, so probably could have done well there. But I cut all of that off and decided just to go all in on PI. Mm. And the reason COVID was a blessing for me was because I was planning on signing $1 million lease in March of 2020. We were negotiating the lease in February. March 6, 2020, I got in a car accident on the same street right in front of where that building was located with my wife. We're bedridden for a week. March 12th or 14th, national shutdown. Everything is shut down. Everyone's scared about COVID. My team members at the office are saying they're scared to come into the office. They don't want to work anymore. So I just said, you have laptops, you have your phones, go work from home. And we never went back to the office again. I saved the $1 million lease, ended up selling my apartment complex, took all of this money and then reinvested it back into marketing and my brand, added a couple hundred thousand followers on TikTok, on Instagram, and grew my business 15% month over month that year in terms of signups instead of new clients, in terms of revenue. And now I realize that anytime there's a recession, anytime there's blood in the water, like if you want to grow, you need to be a shark. So you decided that you wanted to go after the legal industry, but you really honed in on webinars first. So walk us through how you've mastered webinars and then the evolution of this business over the past few years.
Yeah, so the webinars are the key to the whole journey. I have held 400 webinars, like literally 400 webinars I've held.
Are you still doing them?
No, we do one big quarterly event because we become so efficient at it that we don't have to do that high level of frequency. We do a talk show webinar, but there's no kind of pitch in that. It's just value.
There's your social media in.
Yeah, and the webinar format is, if you want to sell something, it comes down to inspiring someone to make a decision. You're excellent at this. You got up on stage at this event. You had everyone stand up, I think, right? That was you? Everyone was standing up when you got on stage.
Oh, yeah. Because people had been sitting down for so long. So the first thing I like to do is get everyone's energy up and blood flowing.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. But, yeah, you did that. But the magic in how you present from stage is the energy. You spoke with so much conviction that everyone stood up when you told them to stand up. Because they could tell you weren't telling them to stand up for your reasons. You were telling them to stand up for their reasons. And that insight is the number one key to selling on webinars. Everyone thinks, and this is sales in general, and you're a master at this. How can I get someone to create a desire for an intended outcome within themselves? I'll say that again. How can I get someone to create a desire for an intended outcome within themselves. It's one thing for me to say you need marketing. It's one thing for you to say you need to spend more money on marketing. It's one thing for you to say you need coaching. Ugh, need. Ugh. It's another thing for me to share stories. You shared this when you were presenting. It's another thing for me to share a story of how a coach changed my life. It's another thing for me to share a story how I spent more money on marketing and what happened as a result of that. It's another thing for me to share a story of a client who spent more money on marketing. So you could follow, obviously the holy grail of webinar presentations is Russell Brunson's perfect webinar script. The problem with that perfect webinar script is that it is so, I have it memorized on the back of my hand, okay? Like, I know how to do a big domino statement, the three secrets, creating an internal desire, external desire, and then crushing all the false beliefs within each of them with stories, picture, parable, principles. I have this unconscious competence. I know how to do that.
Yeah.
And now I've realized that that formula doesn't even matter. What matters is that you create an environment, a learning environment, where someone else can have their own epiphany without you forcing them to have an epiphany. On their own, they sit there, they watch you, and they have their own epiphany. I need to do X. You are never going to change someone's life through a presentation by telling them what to do. And you know what people do when they're anxious? They tell people what to do. I need to show how smart I am. I need to go down a list of all the things that are going to blow their mind and make them so, oh my God, this person's so smart. I don't want to be smart. I want you to feel smart. I want you to feel like you can create your own to-do list. My job is to inspire you to take action on the to-do list you already have identified within yourself. And as soon as you become audience-focused and not self-focused, and again, you are a master at this, right? This comes naturally to you. But the biggest miss is I didn't prepare for any of my speeches at this. I know you didn't prepare for your speech.
Yeah. And I felt, I read the audience, felt the room, and decided I needed to do something different.
Because you need to be audience focused. You need to be audience focused. You need to be audience focused. The best thing to do when you're trying to sell from a stage or anything like that or a webinar is ask the audience, what are you here for? I always start my events. Why even run a law firm? Like, I always start with like the why question. Why are you here? Why are you even running a law firm? Why another year of this crap? What are you doing here? Right?
Do you think you...